Welcome to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. In September, the 9th annual Gila River Festival was held here in Silver City, and today we'll be bringing you the presentation, Wildfire and Climate Changes in the Southwest, Past, Present, and Future, by Dr. Tom Swetnam, Regents Professor and Director of the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona. Dr. Swetnam studies changes in climate and forest disturbances using dendrochronology, the analysis of annual tree rings. He has worked extensively on wildfire history and ecology in pine and giant sequoia forests of the western U.S., Mexico, and South America. He's currently studying fire, climate, and carbon dynamics in central Siberia. The 9th annual Gila River Festival examined the impacts of climate change on the Gila River and the Gila region and how we can meet our future water needs and ensure that a free-flowing Gila River, one of the last in the Southwest, continues to exist for future generations. Dr. Swetnam discusses how multi-year droughts and extensive forest fires have occurred repeatedly during past centuries, but recent events are extraordinary in several ways. Historical documents and tree ring data from the Southwest U.S., including from the Upper Gila Watershed, reveal the details of the causes and consequences of these changes. Despite a gloomy outlook regarding future climate changes, we still have opportunities to learn and apply lessons from both the distant past and from recent outcomes of successful and unsuccessful forest and watershed restoration strategies. Let's join Dr. Swetnam's presentation now.
It's an honor to be here and a pleasure, especially to come back to the Gila. I have a soft spot in my heart for this landscape, in part because I lived here in the late 1970s with my wife and started our young family. Then I was a wildland firefighter up at Gila Hot Springs for the Gila National Forest. Mostly riding helicopter out into the wilderness and hiking out. I did that for three seasons. And my brother Jim was also a firefighter here on the Gila for many years for the Forest Service and lived in Silver City and raised his family here as well. It's a fantastic landscape. And it's seeing big changes now, as we're seeing elsewhere around the West. You see these apocalyptic view here on the slide up above. So my presentation today is about the changes we're seeing in the Southwest. And I often feel somewhat apologetic when I begin this talk, which I give frequently these days, about the changes that are occurring in the West, because it's bad news mostly. It's warning. It's dire predictions. It's the trend arrows are not good. And we have lots and lots of evidence now that points it in these directions, that we're seeing these changes. And we're really good scientists now in my field of study of forest ecosystems and climate and the impacts of climate. We're really good at diagnosing the problem. At least relatively, we're good at pointing out what are the changes that are occurring and most likely why. What we're not good at doing is prescribing what the solutions are. That is because we don't really know what the best solutions are, and they're highly, highly varied, and they really require communities to solve the problems. And it's going to take all of us to figure out how to deal with these problems. So my apology is that I'm mostly, again, talking about the problems and the diagnosing the problems and not really pointing out what the solutions are. At the end of the presentation, I have some words about that. And I think the Gila is actually a fantastic place to learn from. And it's because this is a place, this is one landscape where I think some significant progress has been made in terms of reintroducing fire and trying to restore healthy watersheds and healthy ecosystems with mixed success, but still some success at some scales that really you can't find examples of this kind of scale of, I think, effect of reintroducing fire in almost any other place in North America. So the problems, you see massive fires like the Wallow Fire, and then this kind of scene, you know, it's all across the West and other places around the world, including Australia, Greece, and other places in South America. Mushroom clouds rising above cities. And this is all over LA, Los Angeles, downtown LA, a station fire burning within miles of the city. And the problems are highly, highly variable. And if me included, we have to be careful not to overgeneralize what are the causes of the problems. And, okay, so the solutions are also different as well. In the case of Southern California, it's really much more about where people have chosen to live and where they built their homes. In chaparral landscapes, predominantly steep canyons with shrub communities that burn every 30 to 50 to 60 years and have for hundreds of years and millennia. It's a vegetation type that is adapted to high severity standard replacing fires. Okay? And people have chosen to live in those places. And the government and all our society has supported that and enabled that. And so the problem there is we got the power lines, right? You know, carbon going into the atmosphere and generating the heat that may be part of the problem. The wildland urban interface there, firefighters at risk, technology, big slurry planes. So the Gila, of course, I mean, we're seeing these mushroom clouds too, repeatedly, this last summer, Silver Fire. And before, the summer before, the Whitewater Baldy Fire, right? And these are awesome events. The Silver Fire, notice particularly this really tall plume. I saw some reports, I don't know if they've been verified, 35, 40,000 foot tall plume, which is really tall. That's putting it up into the lower stratosphere. And a certain class of fire, you know, really high severity fire events that will punch that high up into the stratosphere. Really interesting because they actually are delivering black soot into the upper atmosphere, which then can circulate around the planet. And it's only a subset of fires that get that hot. But my main point is you're seeing these events repeatedly. You're not imagining it that, you know, there's more fire on the landscape today, there's more extreme events on the landscape today. It's happening in many different places, and it's not all bad. In fact, you know, one can make the case that some of these fires are actually doing a lot of ecological good. I'll come back to that. So this is just off the web. Last night I saw this story from the rainfall on top of these landscapes. Extreme rainfall events, in some cases, perhaps related to the fires under the same watersheds, allowing an increased runoff, but also extraordinary rainfall events that may have generated floods even without the fires. So this is happening in Colorado, as we know. And some of recent findings about climate change and what may be happening with the jet stream and its connection with extreme events. But when I saw this, I was deja vu. And when I was here in the 70s, late 70s, living here in Mimbres and working out of Gila Center, we called it up at the Cliff Dwellings, firefighting, the big floods of 1978. Anybody around 1978? Remember the flooding? The Gila River flooded pretty big. Took out the bridge right there. Actually, that's my friend on the right there, Jimmy Hickson, standing in front of the bridge taken out, leading up to the visitor center up there, the Cliff Dwellings. And down on the right, it was Lawrence Garcia and Brad Black, a couple of my firefighting colleagues from up there, for some reason hauling some bedroom furniture across the river because the bridge was taken out. And on the left, upper left, this is my wife Suzanne. In 1978, she's like 8 and a half months pregnant there, and it flooded. And you see that down the road, you can't really see it. There's actually a side canyon putting boulders and rocks across the road there. And we're sitting there, Mimbres, thinking, oh my gosh, don't start labor now because we're able to get out. And that's actually the Mimbres. That's the Mimbres group right there in the lower. It's this, you know, up there at the top, history never repeats itself, but it tends to rhyme. And my point on this is that, you know, there are natural events. Climate varies a lot. You know, there are oscillations of wet periods and dry periods. And we've had extreme floods in the past. We've had extreme fires in the past. But we are also now seeing extreme events that are enhanced, increased, amplified by humans. So in some cases, what we may be seeing is a sort of quasi-natural event that is a pattern that's happened in the past, but now it's amplified. The effects are amplified by the additional warming that's occurred in recent decades, or also because of the changes to the landscape that we have brought about through various practices, ranging from fire suppression to livestock raising to harvesting trees and many other things. So it's the combination of these things, and separating them out is not always possible. The trends are pretty clear. This paper published with colleagues 7 years ago, I think already, in Science, we looked at large fires across the whole western United States. And we're looking at only the big fires over about 1,000 acres. And we were only able to get good records back to the 1970s or so. And then we looked at the trend, so that the large fires are the black line at the top, or excuse me, the red bars are the numbers of large fires. And the black line, we looked at it in comparison to temperature and other climate variables. And temperature was one of the strongest variables, especially spring temperature. So the warmer the spring, the more large fires occur. And it is clearly an effect of, especially the effect of reduced snowpack. If you have an earlier spring in the beginning of the year, the snow melts earlier. So by the time you get into the summer, the fuels have dried out. The soils and the heavy fuels have dried out. And this effect is really pronounced, especially in the higher elevations in the northern states of the western U.S. Overall, the increase in numbers of large fires is 6 times more large fires, of these 1,000 acres and larger fires, in the last 20 years, the most recent 20 years, compared to the previous 20 years. 6 times more. You see the same thing with the area burn records across the western U.S. The graph on the bottom there is the length of the fire season. So if you look at when these large fires are first reported and when they're put out, the duration of these large fires, and you track that through time, basically we've increased the length of the fire season more than 2 months. Over the last 20 years, the duration of the fire season on average is about 2 months longer over the whole western U.S. than it was in the previous 20 years. Now, there's a lot of variability on place to place. If you go around the western U.S., you won't find these same trends. You go to different elevations, you won't find these same trends. But at the big picture, yes, you do. You see the increasing numbers of large fires, mega fires. This just shows the distribution of them. On the right, you see the early snowmelt years versus late snowmelt years. These are the sizes of these circles are proportional to the sizes of the fires that occurred in the early snowmelt years versus the late snowmelt years over that period of time. So really, it's the early snowmelt years. And notice that most of these big fires are in the northern states. We've had a lot of the big ones down here too, but more area burn in the higher elevation northern states. And this is one of the reasons why interpretation that the warming is the major factor of this over the whole western U.S. Because these northern states and the higher elevations, they are tending to be more of the spruce fir, lodgepole pine type forests, where fire suppression, putting fires out, has had less effect or no effect because they were long interval fire regimes. They didn't have the classic frequent surface fires that we have in ponderosa pine forests. So arguably, they haven't changed as much. And that's borne out with most of the studies of these forest ecosystems in the north. They haven't changed that much in the last few years. Yet now they're burning a lot more. Now, in the southwest, clearly it's warming too, and increasingly so. And the changes in fuels, the increased density of our forest fuels, are combining. It's this amplifying effect. One point about that, the reason why I can say that with more confidence, think about it. We're getting now fires that are well over 100,000 acres in size, many of them. The Wallo fire, which I showed you the first slide, more than 500,000 acres. The rodeo chetus guy, more than 400,000 acres. The whitewater baldy was 200 and something. Huge fire. And the next largest fires before 1980 were up in forest landscape, about 50,000 acres. The McKnight Fire, 1951, in the Black Range, was the largest fire in forest ecosystem in the Southwest, going back to 1910. Okay, so you go before 1910, and you start seeing a lot more big fires, because that's back in the era before they're putting fires out. So my point is that the large fires now are like orders of magnitude larger, 10 times larger in some cases, than the largest fires we've seen before 1980. Yet, we had fuels. We had to change forests. We know that we had very dense forests on the Mogollon Rim, for example, by the 1950s. People were documenting forests with 5,000, 10,000 stems per acre on the Mogollon Rim in the 1950s. But still, the fires that occurred in the 1950s were not 500,000 acres.
We'll be right back after this short break and continue with Tom Swetnam's presentation at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Let's hear more from Dr. Tom Swetnam's Gila River Festival presentation on wildfire and climate changes in the Southwest.
So something else has happened besides the fuels. It's warming, but it's both warming and the fuels. Okay, the Southwest, it does have a very clear signal in the association between the area burn and the climate data. This is two different comparisons of area burn record with temperature at the top. It's a seasonalized temperature composite of June and July. And then the bottom right is the precipitation that's over a long period. So it's kind of accumulating the precipitation from the prior summer all the way through the current fire season to the end of September. So it's a long, more than annual look at precipitation. And the black, the red line is the area burned record. And the black is the precipitation and temperature. And I flipped the scales on this so that it's kind of off the screen on the right here. You've got, in this case, you've got low precipitation is at the bottom, and high is at the top. That's right. And then you've got the area burned is high at the bottom on that lower right. So it's basically showing the correspondence. And then at the upper one, you've got the area burned flip, so that the high area burned is at the upper end of the scale, comparing with the higher temperatures. Okay, so it's the same area burned time scale. The changes are pretty obvious, and you know, we can debate about whether or not global warming is responsible for the droughts that we've been seeing in the Southwest and the heat waves that are occurring in the Southwest and the West. There's increasing evidence that indeed these regional scale effects of global warming are real. They're starting to happen here in the West and Southwest. That is still arguable to some degree. In my view, it's not arguable that the globe is warming up, the planet is warming up, and largely caused by humans. Okay. But you can still just look at the type of data itself for the lower 48. That is the temperature record for spring, March to May, for the lower 48 states. And that's a pretty darn significant trend there of warmer spring temperatures. Those red bars from about the mid-1980s, clearly a shift to predominantly warm springs. And this has had a big effect on our fires. Just incidentally, notice that the 2012, last year, broke the prior record of the warmest spring over the contiguous 48 states that had been set in 1910. 1910 is a very famous year for firefighters and for fire history. It was the year when something like 90 people were killed in Idaho and Montana, the great fires that burned there. It was the event, the seminal event that really established the firefighting policy. We put fires out. We tried to put them out by 10 a.m. It gave the Forest Service their rationale for existence. And enabled them to survive that era, as they had that mission then, to put fires out. And it was a really warm spring, and led to, it was also a hot summer, and there were big fires. So my point on this is that the warming is occurring, and I don't think it matters at one level of the argument whether it's climate change driven by greenhouse gases, but it is. It's a trend that we're in, and it's likely it's going to continue, and it's causing some of these patterns. It's the primary driver of the pattern. So the continued litany of problems that we're facing with increasing fires, is death of trees, drought-induced mortality, and bark beetle outbreaks. This is a famous sequence. This is from near Bandelier National Monument, taken by my friend Craig Allen, and this is when the pinon trees are dying from drought and also bark beetles. And then this is the next year with the needles falling off. And so all those are dead trees, except for the green ones you see are tending to be junipers, which are a bit more drought hardy. But even the junipers, quite a lot of juniper mortality that's been occurring now, 10 years on, 15 years on in this drought. Okay, so this phenomenon of drought-induced mortality and beetle-induced tree mortality is really widespread. It's a Western North American phenomenon. Massive scale. I mean, you can hardly drive through mountain areas around the West, I'm sure you've seen, and not see dead trees killed either by fire or beetles. And in fact, it's really enormous areas, like British Columbia, that big red blotch up there, tens of millions of hectares of dead lodgepole pine killed by beetles. If this phenomenon was occurring back east, if you had that blotch, that big red blotch of dead trees, like centered right on Washington, D.C. or New York, people would be totally flipping out about it. And this is the, again, the apocalyptic view, one could say alarmist. That's going to happen, actually, with warming temperatures. If we continue on this track, there's going to be big blotches of dead trees in the eastern United States, too, when forests start flipping over. The trajectories are clear across the western U.S. I mean, this is one study where they went to all the best plot data they could find for forests. So they recorded trees and the survival of trees over time. So these are inventories, repeated inventories and plots across the western U.S. And what they see over time are these trajectories on the right of mortality. This is a mortality rate across all species, across age classes, across subregions, across ages of trees and sizes, and just increasing numbers of dead and dying trees. This cannot be explained by local ecological factors over this large a scale, over this variety of species types and places. It's climate, it's dry conditions, and hot conditions, especially dry these patterns, primarily in combination with insects and fire. Well, over the last couple of decades, we've been seeing these patterns across the western U.S., and the question is, well, how much of an effect is this over the long term? How much is it accumulating? How much of an effect of a cumulative effect is this? And a few years ago, Park Williams, who's now a scientist at Los Alamos Labs, and a group of us compiled these data across the Southwest, looking at forests affected by bark beetles and wildfires. And the wildfires we were looking at, primarily the moderate and high severity classified areas. So areas that have been mapped to have either substantial amount of mortality of trees or a very high amount of mortality, like 70 or 80% or more mortality of trees in wildfires. And then we took also the bark beetle affected areas of high severity, high proportion of trees killed by bark beetles and other insects. So that's in the yellow. The bark beetles are in the yellow, and the reds are in the wildfires. You see the rodeo chestnut, the big blotch. So this was running up until I think these data ran up to only 2006. Okay, and just based on that number, we came up with like at least 18% of the forest area had experienced severe, high levels of mortality. That shock you? Maybe not. Well, maybe. For me, being trained as a forester in part, that's shocking. You know, in a decade or two decades, to lose, let's say, almost 20% of your forest area, or having a significant amount of tree death over 20% of your forest area, that's not sustainable. On the long term, that is not sustainable. Basically, one or two more decade-long droughts like this, you can lose half. And actually, now if you add in, I didn't have the actual map parameters, the big fires of recent years. In fact, and this doesn't include the Silver Fire, and then includes some other big fires. Those big blotches, if you add in the fires that have occurred since 2006, I would hazard, we haven't done these numbers yet, but I would hazard with the area is like 25% of the forest area. It's now had substantial mortality. The point is that this is not, I mean, this kind of tree death is not sustainable over the long term. And it's going to have increasing impacts on wildlife and watersheds, and it already is.
We'll be right back after this short break and continue with Tom Swetnam's presentation at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Let's hear more from Dr. Tom Swetnam's Gila River Festival presentation on wildfire and climate changes in the Southwest.
This paper, another rather gloomy outlook of what's the trajectories and the patterns. Again, Park Williams leading on this. We're looking at what we call forest drought stress. And this is an index that we calibrated using temperature and precipitation variables, and another variable which is called vapor pressure deficit. And what that is it's a measure of how much moisture is in the atmosphere, or the lack of moisture in the atmosphere as a function of its temperature. So basically, the warmer the atmosphere, the greater the capacity of the atmosphere to hold moisture. And then the difference between what is the maximum amount of moisture that the atmosphere can hold at a given temperature and the actual amount of moisture that's in the atmosphere at that temperature is the deficit. Okay? So what happens is it's a nonlinear relationship. It's, as it gets warmer, as the atmosphere gets warmer, it has more and more ability to hold water, and it's a nonlinear. It's like a sponge. So as the temperature gets warmer, it actually is pulling the water out of the foliage and the vegetation and the ground more rapidly, increasingly rapidly. Okay? So vapor pressure deficit is one of the key variables in this forest drought stress. And we found that this forest drought stress index is very well correlated with area burned and with bark beetle killed forest. It's also very well correlated with satellite measurements of the vegetation, what's called as NDVI. It's the Normalized Vegetation Index, which is a measure of the greenness of the vegetation across the Southwest, very well correlated. Here's the FDSI compared to tree ring records. Okay, so we were able to actually take this FDSI, a measurement from these different climate variables, from observed climate variables, from thermometers and rain gauges and the calculation of vapor pressure deficit, and we correlated it with tree ring widths, the widths of the tree rings. Very well correlated, 0.91. So the variations in our tree ring widths across the whole Southwest, extremely well correlated. And worse news on this, okay, so the tree ring records have been used to study climate history all across North America, and the Southwest is probably the best place to do tree ring studies. The variations in the ring widths are really closely coupled with climate. In this case, we were able to reconstruct FDSI. It's forest drought stress. Okay, all the way back to 1000 AD. We have really old trees here in the Southwest. We also have archaeological sites that we have tree rings from. So that line, that squiggly line at the top, is a tree ring estimate of the forest drought stress over the last 1000 years. Very interesting. Lots of variability. I mean, overall, when you look at that, you say, well, yeah, the modern era is not all that unusual. There are some big swings in the past. Back in the late 1300s, look at that big jump drop there. Going back a little earlier, look at the around 1150 and around 1100, 1150, some big drops. That's when late 1100s, the Mimbrist culture, I believe, is beginning to rapidly change, if not collapse, and the Chacoans, people of Chaco Canyon, have left Chaco Canyon around that time. The late 1200s, that big drought there in the late 1200s, that was the drought that basically drove the Anasazi off of the Colorado Plateau, and they moved to the Rio Grande. There have been big droughts in the past. Now we're experiencing another one, right here at the very end there of the record, after 2000. Okay, so arguably, we're not seeing extraordinary climate at this kind of scale, this kind of variable, not truly outside the range of variation yet. But clearly, it is warming. We're having unusually warming temperatures on top of the graph. Now, the bottom graph is the scary one, right? So what he's done here is he's taken the models, the climate change models, the global circulation models that we have, which provide an estimate of how much warming and how much variations in rainfall may occur in the future if we continue to pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And so we have models now that will project for us out to 2100 or later, through this next century, how much temperature increase are we going to continue to get, and how much rainfall changes are we going to get into the next century if we keep cranking greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And those models are now downscaling those estimates to a region level so we can look at the Southwest. So this is a Southwestern calibrated model. It's actually a set of like 20 models looking forward into the future, beyond today. So you see where we are today? There's 2000. We're just a decade or so past that. Where the black line ends, that's where we are today. The red are the model predictions. The brown line there, the brown horizontal line, that is are the worst droughts of the past 1,000 years. Okay? So that brown line there is basically the really droughty conditions. And look what happens is that by the time you get to about 20, you can tell me what you think with your eyeballing it, maybe 2040, 2045, 2050, not that far away, folks. When you get there, the average conditions, the average predicted conditions are about what the worst droughts of the last 1,000 years were. So the models are telling us that we're basically heading to an average condition. It's like the worst droughts. Okay? So at the top there, for example, you see the worst droughts, the late 1300s drought, the 2010 drought, the 1580s drought, mega drought, that level, we're heading toward that as being an average condition. Now, maybe the models are wrong. Let's hope they are. But no, they're probably not. And these are like 20 different models and you know, the best climatologists and modelers all around the world, different institutions, all of them trying to get it right. And that's the consensus statement of our best scientific knowledge. There's reason to be worried that we're heading for some troubles. All right, and you know, we're beginning to develop models of what the fire responses are likely to be, increases. I mean, you would expect with warmer temperatures, increasing drought stress, more tree stress, more fire. So this is just one paper, just recently out, atmospheric environment, and these are the percentages increases in area burn going on out into the 21st century. So look at the Southwest. We're the worst place. Now, these are empirical models. They're projecting outward, given the trends and the trajectories and the physics of the system. This is what we would expect, but they're probably not accurate. I mean, I think that it's likely that we're going to get to a point where you only burn so much of the landscape, right? And then it's already been burned. And then as things dry out more and more and more, vegetation doesn't regrow. So it's likely that a lot of these trends are overestimated, but still what it means is that we're going to change the vegetation drastically. We're going to change our watersheds drastically. Back to that point of nonlinearity. So this is what, you know, I'm a very worrisome guy. Todd, you might remember, I think Craig and I were the urgent guys, right? 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I'm increasingly so, because what I see are these trajectories, and they're not just linear. Many of these systems are nonlinear. The responses don't just kind of like As you warm the temperature up, the number of fires just ramps up at an even rate. No, it has a curving, upward curve to it. It's nonlinear. These are the phenomena that we see with vapor pressure deficit. As the temperature increases, the vapor pressure deficit is nonlinear. And actually, if you look at area burned, the numbers of large wildfires, it's also nonlinear. As temperature increases, the numbers of large wildfires is increasing nonlinearly. And you can see this at different scales. Fire behavior itself is nonlinear. And there have been extraordinary fire behaviors in recent decades and in recent fire events. This one, this particular fire, really just kind of, it's kind of hard to be surprised when you've been talking about this for a long time, a decade or two, that we're gonna see more fire and bigger fires, and then we have some bigger ones, but you're still surprised at how they behave and what they actually do. This fire, Las Conchas fire, near Los Alamos, this thing burned about 40,000 acres in about 8 hours. 40,000 acres in 8 hours. The McKnight fire burned about 50,000 acres over more than 2 weeks, okay? And this thing, when it was burning, it was like a tornado. It was literally a vortex. It was a double vortex, so two spinning vortices on this thing. There's a YouTube video of this if you want to check it out. Michael Zeiler, if you do a Google on horizontal roll vortex on Google, you'll probably see this thing. And if there's a video of this thing, and you can actually see the rotation of it. And there are flames that are well over 2,000 feet high. That's about 2 miles across the base of that spinning vortex. So this thing moved really, really fast. And the crazy thing was, we don't really know what happened at night. The winds calmed down, so there were winds blowing it, and at night it seemed to produce more vertical columns, or more of a plume-driven wildfire, and the plumes were collapsing. So these big, 30,000-foot columns of smoke and material collapses, and when it hits the ground, it blows wind in all directions. And the wind was blew the fire down the mesas there above the Rio Grande, almost all the way to the Rio Grande, through pinyon juniper woodland. So this was pinyon juniper woodland. That dead tree on the left is an alligator juniper. Okay, this was like, at the lower end of this, this is like pygmy, stunted, sparse pinyon juniper woodland that you see in the middle of Rio Grande. Not like the dense pinyon juniper woodland you have around Pinos Altos and here around Silver City. It's really sparse pinyon juniper woodland where fire won't carry in there, all ordinarily. And the fire just blew right through there and really, really hot. Basically burned up everything. And I've never seen anything like that. I have never seen any evidence that this kind of fire has burned in the middle of Rio Grande like that. I challenge you to find an area of snags or charred logs that would show that a fire like this burned in that middle Rio Grande PJ woodland anytime in the last 500 or 1,000 years. So extraordinary event, okay? Now, this is where, coming back to all of us, this is dangerous. I mean, we're talking about really crazy fires that have these kind of behaviors that are off the charts. So what if, I think it's appropriate that we ask the what if. What if that happens around Silver City? Can it happen? And what's at risk? What are the places where this could possibly happen? This is a very difficult question to answer because it depends on fuel and wind and all sorts of things. But this is a concern many of my fire colleagues, I think, are beginning to deal with, is this possibility that we could be looking at these kind of extraordinary fire spread events occurring in just the wrong place and people not being able to get out of the way. And there are many of these in the last several decades. The Wallow Fire, the Rodeo Chedisky Fire. So overall, we can look at a landscape like this. It burned, some hundreds of thousands of acres, 538,000 acres. And overall, the fire might have done some pretty good. It actually burned up a lot of the fuels, a lot of the light green colors there are the lower severity. So there was actually some forest fuel treatment being accomplished in these fires. All right, so we can be happy about that. where we have to be worried are these big patches, like that big red patch right there that I have an arrow up to. That is one of the runs. That's one of these runs that, you know, that there were multiple days, I think there were like 3 days during the Walla fire where more than 60,000 acres burned in a single day, okay? And some of those big red patches are these incredible runs, wind-driven fires, and they're burning really, really hot. Virtually no trees surviving in those patches. So this is the, I don't know that Silver City or Pinos Altos or any of your surrounding communities are, you know, kind of in the bullseye of this kind of a phenomenon. You have to look at prevailing winds and the fuels. But there's an issue about these things, what they do, even when they're not wind driven, because of the collapsing plume phenomenon, is that even if you're not in the direction of the prevailing wind, where one of these events can run, could run through a city or a village or a town, the question is, are you in a place where a collapsing plume would drive fire down into a wildland urban interface? So this is all this kind of scary stuff that, you know, again, I say it with some degree of caution that I don't want to sound alarmist. I'm sounding that way anyway. But it is something I think that it's real. We've been seeing these kind of phenomena happening around the West in increasing numbers. And I think it is time for us now to ask, can this happen here? Can this happen in my neighborhood? The other thing that's happening, of course, are the big fires. We're getting to see this landscape, by the way. This is up by Los Alamos. This is the big caldera, the Bias caldera there in the upper left, and the Pajarito Plateau with Los Alamos on the right. And these are all the fires that have occurred since the 1950s and 1970s. You see the list of them up on the upper right. And then here's the Las Conchas fire. So now what's happening is we're getting reburns. We're getting reburns of previous high severity fires. And the high severity fires in the first place are causing big patches to be killed. And then they come back in some other vegetation because there's not enough seed source. And these big holes, in some cases these are 10,000 acre canopy holes. And you're not getting trees established and you're getting gamble oak. And you get all these fuels. So then when the fire burns through there again, it burns really hot and it kills the remaining conifer trees, which were survived the first event, right? So maybe you get a nice mosaic the first time. But then if the mosaic has too big of patches and it doesn't come back to conifer, and you get another fire through that same landscape, it burns even hotter and the big patches get bigger. And you get these resprouting species like gamble oak and the Mexican locust, and they come back gangbusters. They resprout from the roots. But the ponderosa pine does not. It has to reseed by seeds, okay? So these are landscapes I think are very, we're likely seeing as some conversion, type conversions, where we're getting reburn of these large patches, and these large patches are getting even larger, okay? And I just do not think we're gonna see, you know, a happy story of, well, this is just part of nature and it's just a successional process and there'll be forests there in the future. No, not if the size of these patches are truly extraordinary, plus drought and hot temperatures limit tree establishment, plus wind, dry conditions, or extreme rain events, and you lose the soil. And there is a lot of soil being lost out of these landscapes. We've seen it already.
We'll be right back after this short break and continue with Tom Swetnam's presentation at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Let's hear more from Tom Swetnam's Gila River Festival presentation on wildfire and climate changes in the Southwest.
Let me just say a few last things about climate. Mentioned this at the beginning about the trajectories and trends and extreme events. This comes in with watersheds especially, you know, and the danger of extreme rainfall events and flood events and what that means to our rivers and the health of the stream banks and erosion processes. Extreme events do seem to be increasing. And one of the mechanisms that may be at play here, and this is still a subject of debate in the scientific literature, as to whether or not the jet stream is beginning to respond to the warming temperatures. And the position in this, in the strength of the jet stream is leading to more heat waves and cool waves. So the theory on this was actually developed originally by Rosby. He's sort of the grandfather of climatology. Imagine a scientist, climatologist, being on the cover of Time magazine today. I can't imagine it. That was 1950, something like that. All right. So he developed the basic understanding of the jet stream and how it forms. And I won't go into the complexity of it, except to say that it forms as a result of the temperature difference between the pole and the equator. But the poles are cold, the equator is warm, and the spinning Earth, this creates a cycle of air, very fast moving air, the jet stream, around the northern latitudes. Okay, and it flows from west to east. And when that spinning jet stream is moving really fast, it tends to be really more circular, like that leftmost diagram there. So when you have a very high gradient of temperature, cold, pole, warm, equator, the jet is very fast and it's very linear. But when you decrease the gradient, when the poles warm up and there's less of a temperature difference, it starts meandering like a river. Okay, the physics of this, the analogy would be like a very steep surface, a very steep gradient, and water runs straight down. A flat surface, the water slows down and it starts to meander. Okay, so what the consequence of that is that these meanders then start to form, and the jet is moving very slowly, and those meanders move really slowly east to west. So when you get like, what the meanders do is they allow cold air to come down from the north, and they allow warm, wet air to come up from the south, right? So these big wet periods that we have, and the big hot heat periods, when you have a heat wave, what you've got basically is one of these hot air masses coming and sitting over the southwest for weeks on end. And if they're coming out of central Mexico or somewhere, they tend to be dry, and it sits there for weeks drying things out. Or conversely, you get a trough coming down from the north and it's wet and it just sits there for weeks because the jet is moving so slowly, it rains and rains and rains and rains. There are different things happening with these different troughs and ridges that are occurring. But the theory is that Rosby developed was that if you change the gradient, you're gonna change the jet stream. And there's increasing evidence that this is starting to happen. The paper on the left there provides some of this information. So this is an expectation that we may see more extreme events, more extreme rainfall events, more extreme wind events. This was a condition during the Wallow Fire with the wind. And basically the wind was looping down, the jet stream was looping down in California and then right across the southwest. These southwest winds are pretty common here, but they've been really strong in some of our recent Junes. There is evidence that rainfall events are increasing in magnitude, extreme events. These are extreme one-day precipitation events in the contiguous 48. So look what's happening here at the outside the last few decades. Okay, I'm running out of time here, so I'm gonna roll, skip through stuff really fast. The changes we've been seeing are interrelated to climate for sure, but they're also related to the putting out of fire. And this is the tree ring record that I worked on a lot over the western U.S. We get fire-starred trees, and we can record the history on those trees. And this graph here showing the fire events in about 40 sites or so listed here. And it's a timeline, so you see many, many more fires before 1900 than after 1900. And that is when fire suppression began, and we've seen changes in our forest as a consequence of the lack of these frequent surface fires. And the evidence of these changes is evident in the, it's apparent in the evidence of photographs. You can see this is from the Santa Fe watershed, right above Santa Fe. The photograph on the left, 1935, and the photograph on the right, 2005. The lighter colored areas are sort of grassy savanna type places. And on the right, trees have come into that area. So, big problems here in terms of our fire activity and the connectivity of the fuels. So what do we do about it? Well, reintroducing fire is really, I think, a major, has to be a major part of the solution. And we can do treatments, mechanical treatments with chainsaws where it's appropriate, but we need to also keep fire back in the system. The Gila, I was saying earlier, the Gila is a great place to study and to look at the successes, I think, in landscape scale treatments with fire. So here's the history, the Fire Atlas history from the Gila. You'll recognize on the left the Gila, and then on the right the Aldo Leopold. And the red colors there are the different times these places have burned in the, mostly since 1970s. Okay, so with prescribed fire, with prescribed natural fire, with managed fire, these places have burned a lot, way more than anywhere else in the Southwest. And it's done a lot of good. You know, basically the fires have, most of these fires have not burned big holes. Now, we've been seeing more big holes in some of the recent ones, the last couple of years. But this fire in particular, the Miller fire, I think was really one of the best. It was an expensive fire, because I think they went into emergency firefighting on this one. But the color here, the lighter color you see in the background, the sort of light kind of green and the yellows, those are lower severity. That's where the fire was burning like a surface fire, like this. So here's a video flying over the Miller fire. It's kind of grainy, sorry, but you can kind of see the basic character of most of this fire was like this, right? So you see down through the trees, you can see low severity fire burning through the understory of the trees. A lot of smoke. When I saw this video some months after the fire, you know, it almost made me weep, because this is what these forests need. This is the kind of fire, this is the kind of fires that these forests had for millennia. You know, when you burn a forest every decade or twice a decade, it tends to burn like that. And the effect of those kind of fires, I mean, the beneficial effect of those kind of fires is evident when you get these really hot, dry, windy events like the Whitewater fire. So here's the map of the Whitewater fire. The red is the high severity, okay? And those are some really big holes that blew out, but mostly up in the high elevations. And interestingly, when you looked at what the previous fire history, what effect the previous fire history had, it's apparent, evident that it did moderate these fires, and there was a reduction of severity, and fires tended to go to the ground. Not always, but in many cases, fire actually ran up against fires that had burned, like 2006 Bear Fire, 2002 Cut Fire, and other fires. Fire dropped down to the ground and became much more of a surface fire. So when you go back to this one, you see the yellow color. A lot of the yellow color to the west there, the red, was burning down through landscapes that had been burned one, two, three, even four times, right? So lots of reduction in fire currents. Last slide, very last slide, all right? I just wanted to show you just one last couple of comparisons here of before and after. The Iron Creek fire is the one on the left here. The Iron Creek Mesa area, and before, this is in 1980, and then the recent area in 2012. So my key point about this is that it is possible to mitigate the effects of these high severity fires, and a way to do it is to reintroduce fire where it's possible. But it also is going to be necessary to do some thinning efforts judiciously in the right places.
One of the great problems, it seems, with the Whitewater fire slopes,
yeah.
Where you couldn't do a controlled burn like red. Where
is that? Yeah. Yeah, no, you could do a controlled burn. You could do a, you know, you could allow prescribed fire to burn through there. But with the fuels as they are, and with windy and hot conditions, it's probably going to blow out. So that's where, you know, treating with prescribed fire in these areas really has to be done, you know, patiently, cautiously. The Gila fire program, when they started, they only allowed fires to burn after the monsoon season initially in the first decade. I think it's really wise. And I think the way we should go about it in the future too is you don't have to remove all the fuels in the first year. In fact, you shouldn't probably. It's just too dangerous.
It seems like it's been obvious for years that that's what you said. You need to be more prescribed fire.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like the will is there, that politically
No, it's a huge concern. It's a wicked problem because, yeah, how can you do prescribed fires in and around communities and take the risk of the escape fire? So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this is an easy thing to do, and mostly it's good where we're going to use landscape scale fire. It's going to be in wilderness areas. But, I mean, ultimately, if we're able to do thinning projects around the brewery, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep thinning it every 5 or 10 years? No. I mean, really, we should be moving toward prescribed burning in places where the risks are reduced through early, you know, initial restoration. Okay, my apologies for that.
Thanks for joining us today for Dr. Tom Swetnam's presentation at the 9th Annual Gila River Festival. For more information on the fight to save the Gila River, visit gilaconservation.org. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio.